get the action in rural horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Bonds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at Santa Anita and about a little less than 90 minutes to wrap up this five-week odyssey from Gulfstream to Tampa to Ocala to New Orleans to Arcadia. And then we got the run-up toward Derby. In the meantime, there's also a run-up toward the opening of the season at Canterbury Park, a track that does so many things right, the Sampson family, and so many, you know, portions, Minnesota breeding, and you know, the ownership project that Minnesota, the engagement project that's been successful, and it's agonizing to see what they're dealing with, and the Minnesota Racing Commission last week trying to support both the standardbred and thoroughbred interests by giving a green light for HHR potentially, but the anti-gaming interests, or let's say gaming interests that don't want to see the racetracks and the equine sport portion succeed at having alternate revenue, they've marshaled forces, and it's coming to a head in the legislature. Joe Scorto joins us from the horseman side. Joe, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
No, I appreciate the opportunity to get an update. And we thought that yesterday there may have been even, you know, more, I don't know if you want to call it progress, but there may have been more things decided. But in fact, the hearing that was supposed to take place was delayed until today. First of all, Joe, lay out for everybody so they understand the parameters of what the Racing Commission did last week and the reaction to it and why we are where we are today.
Certainly. I'll try to give you a top line on what's been happening here in Minnesota. And as far as the meeting yesterday, that was pure politics, putting the racing industry at the end of the agenda with over 100 people in the room and testifiers all set up to testify. And then they adjourn, say, come back at 9 o'clock at night, and then they move it till today, knowing that a lot of those folks who work at the racetracks wouldn't be able to be there. So good politics, I guess. But this whole situation started, it's been a couple of years since they've been trying to push sports betting here in Minnesota. And with a survey, 90% of Minnesotans want a racetrack tribal agreement on sports betting. They don't want just the tribes, which is what the bill has been, I guess what the DFL, the Democratic Party in Minnesota, have been pushing, a tribal only bill. So the tribes would have control of sports betting both at their facilities as well as online. And obviously that would impact our business dramatically. We asked for a license. All we wanted was to compete at the beginning, we weren't looking for any handouts or subsidies. We just wanted to compete. And that's been the battle for the last couple of years. And there's been discussions back and forth, some good, not so good. But they started to fall apart recently. And the tribes were pushing basically nothing for the racetracks. I think the latest offer coming from their side and the Minnesota Democratic Party was $600,000 to be split between two racetracks and three breeds of horses on a $40 million business. So at that point, we knew we were up against it. I think it also signaled to the Racing Commission that something else needed to be done. And after a number of years, and I was the former deputy director of the Racing Commission, after a number of years of them looking at historical horse racing, they decided to pursue it, have special meetings. They spent their time. They learned about it. The racetracks presented their case. We're not here in Minnesota. We're not even talking about the historical horse racing you see in Kentucky or Virginia. We're talking about the most basic, paramutually pure form of historical horse racing. The Racing Commission saw it that way. They passed it 5-1 on April 1st. And then all of a sudden the heat turned up.
And by the heat, by the heat, you mean the marshaled forces against these interests, and it took the form of a highly restrictive bill that was introduced that would absolutely not just disallow the opportunity for HHR, but basically would cripple the industry as it exists. Now, I understand that there's been some amending of that original language, but it's hard to believe that the pendulum could swing, you know, to that extreme.
Exactly. And I think you outlined it well. The Racing Commission authorized the installation of 500 HHR machines, which would bring about $5 million of purses for Canterbury, plus breeders' funds and a number of other things that it could help fund. A couple days later, our governor met with the Midwaukee and Sioux, who are the owners and operators of Mystic Lake, which also operates in Shakopee, right down the road from Canterbury Park. And funny the timing, 2 days later, two bills are introduced, one in the House and one in the Senate, that, as you pointed out, basically would have ended horse racing in Minnesota, not only making HHR unlawful, but also taking away things like wagering on more than one race at a time, thus eliminating daily doubles, pick threes, any pick end wagering, getting rid of stadium gaming, which is called dealer assist. That while I was with the Racing Commission, we authorized 7 years ago without a squeak from any of the tribes. Now, all of a sudden, they want to get rid of that as well. And then also the legislature and the governor want to basically castrate the Racing Commission and take away their authority when it comes to card games. You're right. They did amend some of the language so that the daily double part and the pick ends will be okay going forward if this bill passed. But also things in there, anything electronic on track, including the sale of lottery tickets, would be unlawful according to this bill. So we've denoted this bill a revenge bill. That's the way we see it. And there's a whole process with the Minnesota Racing Commission. If somebody thinks something's unlawful or hurting them, there's a process within the government already to address those issues. And when you get legislators coming up and wanting to ban something that they know nothing about, HHR is a complicated issue, as most of the people in the industry understand. And it's been through a number of iterations. But when somebody comes up and says, listen, this is a slot machine and we have to ban it, that's not good government. And that's why we're fighting so hard and trying to get this bill that bans these things stopped. And there's a hearing today, both in the House and the Senate, and I'm sure it'll pass and it'll move quickly to the floor. But hopefully, I guess calmer minds will prevail, and this should go through its normal course of the Racing Commission and the courts if necessary.
What's striking about this is seemingly how much authority the commission had in even, you know, it's one thing in a lot of states, a commission could okay the concept, but I was struck by the fact that the commission, you know, had enough power to potentially enact this.
Well, the Racing Commission has the power to oversee pari-mutuel wagering, and that's what this iteration of HHR is. So there's no question that they have the jurisdiction to do this. And the fact of the matter is if there was any problem with their decision-making, it can be adjudicated through an appeal process that's already in place. The Midwakanton tribe actually filed a writ on November 16th, and that's going through the Court of Appeals currently for the dealer assist game, which they were okay with for 7 years, but all of a sudden, you know, after this move by the MRC, they decided to file a suit. Actually, it was before, but they saw it coming. And, you know, that bill and this... The current bill, I'm sorry, would strip the court of its ability to hear the case by deciding a legal issue in a political forum. So it's very odd, Steve, and everyone in the industry should be very concerned when you've got a situation where a state government is basically looking to put a $400 million industry out of business at the behest of a special interest. Now, I know California probably feels our pain, but when you see things that are happening in Maryland and Kentucky and New York, and where state governments are working with the racing industry to help it grow and thrive, that's heartening for our industry, because it should be these public-private initiatives to help an industry grow and expand. We have too much of an impact on other things like tourism and agriculture and all the things that you know. And from Canterbury's perspective on a national basis, you know, we've always been the little track that could. And they've done so many things in an incubator type situation where the industry can look at some of the good things going on here in Minnesota and enact them on a larger level. So we really appreciate the support that we're seeing on social media and so forth. And we can, all we can really do is ask anybody that wagers on Canterbury or supports Canterbury, you know, to contact the governor here in Minnesota, Tim Walz, or contact Representative Zach Stevenson. And they're both on Twitter and social media, and you can email them and they listen. I mean, so it's important that they know that Canterbury is not just a small track in Shakopee, Minnesota, but also has an impact in the total ecosystem of horse racing in the country.
Joe Scordo joining us from Minnesota under this, you know, this fairly unexpected duress. I've got a kind of a sidebar question. How much of Bob Lothenbach's absence is affecting this? Because if Bob Lothenbach was alive, I imagine there would not be, you know, such an easily established punitive response in terms of influence in the governor's office.
I think that's a good point. I mean, first of all, we miss Bob terribly. He was a big part of Minnesota racing. He supported Canterbury Park. He's in our Hall of Fame. He got involved in both in the forefront and a lot behind the scenes. And no doubt our war chest would be larger if Bob Lothenbach was still with us. And maybe that would help us get our message out further.
And Camilla Catsby.
Yes, yes. I said she still has one of her Minnesota breds, I believe, racing out on the East Coast right now. The horse is 8 or 9 years old, and it's fun watching that horse continue kind of in Cam's spirit. But, yeah, those are the influencers. And we still have a number of folks here that are committed to racing in Minnesota and want to see it thrive. And all we want to do, bottom line, Steve, with all this, and we keep trying to, we just want to compete. Don't shackle us. You've got a situation where all the states around us have some other form of gaming or modification of horse racing. And it's not that the industry, the government, the state government here is spreading, notes that racing can't sustain itself. And that's such a poor argument because, yeah, we're struggling to compete with other jurisdictions because of their support. But the fact of the matter is we can compete and we can thrive as long as we're on a level playing field. And they are doing everything to make sure we are not on a level playing field.
Well, of course, the first stage of what has been, and I don't want to call it a death spiral, last year when the 10-year deal with the Indians, you mentioned Mystic Lake, there was a very successful 10-year period of cooperation and just enough economic input, right, from the Shakopees that made for a very good decade, and it affected last year's meet. Now this is headed in a much more perilous direction.
Yeah, I mean the relationship we had with the Midwakanton and Mystic Lake was a good one. I can't say that it was a bad situation, but part of that deal was that we were banned from the legislature for 10 years to speaking with legislators. And during that time, I think some of the legislators forgot how important Canterbury was to the state. So we've been trying to play catch up a little bit. And when you look at, the situation with Mystic, it would make sense for us to do things together, to be collaborative. And I think Randy Sampson and Canterbury have tried everything they could to continue that relationship, but it just wasn't to be had. So, that provided about $15 million in purse money for Canterbury a couple of years ago. And that's when, like with the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project, we had 300 new owners coming in. We had over 1,000 horses on the racetrack. There were record handles on every special day and even the weekends. Our simulcast signal was strong. And so we proved that even at that level, we could be a successful track. Now you're talking about purse levels that could be down around half that amount. All of a sudden it becomes a real struggle with all the cost increasing as well in horse racing.
Well, and you also had, you'd built up a very active live gate, 7,500 to 8,000 people on track on a daily basis. There's been so many things that the Sampson family have done right. They tried the experiment with the across-the-board takeout reduction, which, grew handle. There was some key learning, I think, industry-wide about the necessity of a widespread application of reduced takeout to make it successful for everybody, because there's never a guarantee that if one track lowers takeout, the money, the churn automatically comes right back to that track. It did grow handle. It didn't necessarily offset the difference in the takeouts, but the fact that that Randy was willing to try it says a lot. The 10% takeout on pick end bets that pick five that Canterbury currently has. I mean, the messaging is so good from Canterbury. This is this is really seems very unfair, Joe. And
I mean, your point is really good, Steve. The fact is, and we'll jump to more of an industry thing because you brought up the takeout. The industry needs tracks like Canterbury Park. They need them so that things like that can be done on a smaller level and then tweaked or brought nationally to some of the larger jurisdictions and racing communities. Even the ownership program we had here, that was an incubator for if you're really looking to bring owners into your racing, this is the way to do it. And, you know, for the amount of money that Churchill has added even to the Derby, that's enough to get a track like Canterbury up to the next level. And so I think our battles here are going to become the battles other states see. That's why we certainly appreciate the support of the industry. And we've heard from them. We've heard from the National HBPA. We've heard from these different groups that want to support our efforts. And we'll be reaching out to them in the coming days as well to gain their support. Because this is an industry issue, and we appreciate the time on this show to get the word out and appreciate all the support we've been seeing on social media as well, because Canterbury needs to be part of racing.
No doubt. And you got a strong stakeholder community, and you mentioned obviously the breeding side, and there's, you know, plenty of vitality. So this is short-sighted on any number of levels of involvement. Joe Scordo, I appreciate it. The opportunity to catch everybody up on where things stand. We'll watch for today's. Is Randy testifying today in front of that committee?
Randy will be testifying. Justin Revac from the Minnesota HBPA, along with a couple other interested parties. So I appreciate the time, and please, whatever you can do, tweet, email. It's at Gov Tim Walls or at Zach Stevenson with a PH and hashtag Revenge Bill. Everyone's help is appreciated.
Joe Scordo, we'll stay in touch. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your time, Steve.
Joe Scordo for the Minnesota Horsemen, and we've come full circle. We got an hour to spend, and Bill Nader joins us as promised, and wasn't going to leave town without spending some time with Bill. And we started in Maryland, where the news is just miraculous and ebullient. Then we stop in Minnesota, where it's like there's a trap door that somebody decided to foist on these people. It's actually shocking. We'll round things out with a California report. And you know, we visited, 3 weeks ago before the CHRB meeting. Bill, it does feel like, after a terrific Santa Anita Derby weekend, it does feel like the cards are on the table. That now, you know, after some uncertainty, everybody now kind of knows. Yes, Craig Fravel came in under the crosshairs with the letter, but it feels like it actually kind of opened up everybody's eyes and mind, and now everybody's rolling up the sleeves and let's figure out where we go from here.
I think it's a good assessment, Steve. I mean, you were here, by the way, for the past week, and you were here for Santa Anita Derby Day, and I think it's important to start by saying, you know, let's look at the positive side. I mean, this is just a remarkable racetrack. It's just a gorgeous setting, and on a big day like that, on Saturday, to see, you know, a guy like DeTore come out and rip off six in a row and then get to the Santa Anita Derby riding the favorite for Baffert and a chance for seven. The feeling of, you know, the great race place in, you know, big race California was live, and it was great to see that. And I think it was important for everybody here to give a jolt of enthusiasm. You know, a guy like DeTore, you know, riding here day in and day out throughout the classic meet last year and this year, you know, I think maybe for a lot of people, maybe it's lost on them, but, you know, there's a guy, I always like to say the three E's for DeTore: experience, excellence, but the last one, enthusiasm, that he still brings.
Yeah.
And you could see it on Saturday, and I just think for the crowd, on track and those watching via simulcast or wherever they were. It was just an exciting day, and this is one of the few tracks that I think that lines up as in the conversation with the most beautiful or magnificent racetracks in the world, and it's a gem. And also we have Del Mar, and of course that brings us also to Golden Gate, which will close down on June 9th. And you talk about, you know, Minnesota and Maryland, and that, you know, and Golden Gate comes into the equation, and it's closing down on June 9th. And at the meeting in March at the CHRB last month, I think you're right. The cards were placed on the table. It was decided that there would be an allocation of race dates at Pleasanton Racecourse from October 19th to December 15th, which would equate to 26 race days. That would be the beginning of Golden State Racing. Now, they still need to be licensed, but at least the allocation was approved. And so for the North, they have a pathway. And for the industry in California, we have a task at hand to try to make it work and for everybody to come together and find common ground of how we work it out. Now, from a licensing point of view, that will come up probably in August. That would be the deadline that the CHRB set. There'll be certain questions that still remain unanswered in terms of whether Pleasanton could be licensed. That gets down to such items as funding, environmental compliance, how they treat the golf course at Pleasanton and how that situation is resolved. But those are things that we don't have any party to. We leave that to the operator and the regulator. From our side, we'll work on the mechanics of how we can work it out and how we what we believe would be the right formula to pull it together, and also to try to get benchmarks as to what would determine what is viable. The TOC said from the very beginning they would support a plan, any plan in the North where it was viable. I guess the question then is the definition of viability and sustainability, and hopefully we can all agree what that definition is. I think because for owners and breeders to walk into something, of course you're going to be optimistic, but if it doesn't deliver what is needed to keep the industry afloat in the North, then we need to at least understand what those KPIs and what those benchmarks are to determine success or fail.
And of course, you know, part of this equation, not just part of it, but central to it, is this simulcast revenue question. One part that has seemingly, and I'm speculating somewhat, just ear to the ground, there seems to be a movement afoot and some hope that there could be an alternate revenue source that is attainable via Sacramento, and that has materialized to in some form. I mean, is that a fair assessment that there's some quiet lobbying going on as part of the movement to make sure that Santa Anita Park remains the centerpiece of Southern California racing on an ongoing basis?
I think it's much too early to jump to that. I think it might be in its infancy. I think the one thing I would draw from what's happened in the last month or so is the industry has really been brought to its knees in terms of where we are. And there is a need, hopefully, for Sacramento to step in and try to support an industry that generates 37,000 jobs. I'm talking about the horse racing industry, not the horse industry, but horse racing, that sector. It's 37,000 jobs. It's $2.5 billion annually in income. You have these tremendous racetracks that, you know, when you think about not just jobs and economic impact, but tourism and sporting entertainment, history, tradition. And I think the main thing that I think is terribly overlooked is that for decades, you know, horse racing paved the way for gambling within the state, showing that there could be responsible gaming at a you know, defined destination, meaning the racetrack, where, you know, people like Bing Crosby and the Stars came out, and horses like Seabiscuit, who became, you know, a Hollywood hit, and all the great horses and all the great jockeys, everything. It's been such a great run. And then came things like the lottery and casinos on tribal land, but it was horse racing that paved the way, and it was horse racing that was the pioneer, and it's horse racing that did the heavy lifting. So hopefully there'll be some recognition, and I don't want to lose sight of that fact, because, you know, it's not just that we're in a difficult situation and we're being challenged and we need help. We've been here a long time, and there's a long history of about 100 years, and it shouldn't be overlooked. And I think even from the standpoint of the tribes, when we sit down and have a real conversation, they should appreciate those points. And so I think there's room. I think it's too early to say that there's been a great progress on that, but hopefully we can be heard, and hopefully we can get a result.
Well, and with that in mind, I do want to make one point, because over the last month, let's say, the two sets of weekend cancellations that was met with all kinds of eye rolling and you know, cat calling from supposed, you know, people that love the game. If you don't understand the necessity of the operating team here to absolutely be on 24/7 alert to minimize and to absolutely operate with zero incidents, and you know, there's been, you know, it's an unattainable goal, but if you don't understand why it's so important to take those rain weekends off and cancel, Sacramento, the pressure that was involved going back to 2019, it's pretty difficult to go negotiate some support from people who are being assaulted by other constituencies about, you know, the dangers and the horror of thoroughbred racing. So have a heart when it comes to, you know, supporting the decisions on that front, because there's no safety net here. I mean, there's no margin for error.
Yeah, when you talk about the brand and reputation, when I mean the brand, I mean the sport and the reputation and credibility, and you're going and you're looking for some support to sustain your future, well, you better get your foundation right. And I give a lot of credit to everyone that responded the way they did back in from the events of 2019. And Belinda Stronach gets a lot of credit because she stood up and took a very powerful lead position. But where we are now is in a pretty terrific place in terms of record over the last few years. Even last year, when you look at the equine industry database, and the national average was 1.32 fatalities per 1,000 starts, Del Mar was zero. Del Mar had no racing fatalities. Santa Anita was at 0.64, which was less than half of the national average. And Golden Gate, as always, came in with a very good score. So California continues to be the number one state in the country right now over the last 3 years or more in terms of safety and welfare and the record that they put forth on the racetrack. So they've really turned it around in California, and the record now is the blueprint for success. And so while those can be critical when there are some cancellations and they can point to years ago, while we ran on tracks like that, times have changed. And we've had to change with the times. And now we're in a pretty good place, a very good place. And I think everybody should embrace that.
Bill Nader with us from the TOC. And, of course, Leo Vukmanovic, and I am going to utilize Leo's presence too, and kind of morph this conversation, Bill, into something that you know, that Leo can, you, the two of you, I think will have an interesting interaction, because I want to draw on your, you know, long experience in track management, of course, the time at NYRA, and then the stints at the Hong Kong Jockey Club. And, you know, so you've operated under, you know, now really three fascinating elements and configurations of racing. And Leo's a tech guy, came from the world of IT, and really probably understands, you know, some of the toad issues better than probably anybody, especially because he understands the origin, you know, where things started and where technology has gone, you know, versus the way the industry has responded, essentially. And you equally, you know, have got this extreme where, you know, Hong Kong operating at the highest level. I would love for you to, you know, to either regale us with success story and what the industry, you know, should be, what the North American racing industry should be pulling from. I say frequently that, you know, we can't operate the way people say, oh, we should be more like Hong Kong. Okay. Thank you for that input. There's some elements that just aren't going to work. I mean, the Hong Kong Jockey Club owns the horses. They bring the horses in. It's a completely different, it's literally an island that operates uniquely. But there are some lessons to be gleaned. And I'd love for you to, you know, to explain what kinds of things we need to be doing as an industry on a wider basis, you know, to have us prepared for a future, because these most recent toad issues have been the most glaring problems. Other things are fixable, but it I think the horse player community is getting a sense that things are adrift when it comes to managing the tote, the CAW incursion, some thoughts, Bill, about, you know, the juxtaposition about the international marketplace versus, you know, what feels like, you know, a domestic management of tote that is, you know, 30 years behind the times.
Well, I think the main principle, Steve, would be the integrity of the competition and the integrity of the wager are linked, right? And the integrity of the wager is to make sure that, you know, the policies in place and the execution is, you know, ironclad. And there's nothing, you know, we talked about years ago the pick six fix at the Breeders' Cup and what's happening modern day in terms of breakdown within the tote. Now, in Hong Kong, the Hong Kong Jockey Club owned and operated the tote system, own and operate the tote system. So there isn't it's not outsourced, and it's high-powered because the number of transactions that go through that tote, especially in the last two cycles of wagering, is incredible volume when you consider that on each of their 88 race days, their handle is greater than a Breeders' Cup Saturday, and that includes, you know, a Wednesday night where there's only eight races. The volume is phenomenal. But in, you know, I don't think that there's a huge difference between domestic and international, because everybody, you know, the pools have opened up. Wagering in the States is, you know, there are wagers coming in from overseas and vice versa. So it's not too dissimilar, but in terms of infrastructure and Leo can speak to this better than I can, but when you get behind the curtain in terms of protecting that integrity and having everything in place that one needs to give the customer the assurance that, you know, the integrity is there, then I think we fall a bit short.
You were still at NYRA in 2002, yes?
I was at NYRA through early 2007. So I was there for 14 years, but I was there for the 2002 Breeders' Cup, which was at Arlington.
We've been told and when I say we've been told, no one is too forthcoming, to be honest. TRPB refuses to comment on anything that they say that any time there's an investigation, it's between them and those that initiated, asked for the initiation. For instance, Tampa, called on an independent investigation of the tote meltdown on Tampa Bay Derby Day. So we've been told that things were improved markedly. Process and systems were enhanced, protocols after 2002. But every so often there's an incident like this one from Tampa Bay Derby Day that kind of flies in the face of that, that tells us, even with supposed improvements, the bets aren't safe, and they're not being processed in a manner that guarantees us as bettors that we're in the pool. It's amazing how often there's an incident like this, and there's the outcry and the complaint, and then, we move on to other priorities, and we never get a follow-up, which seems to be happening in this case. Leo, for your end, because you were very helpful to me from an IT standpoint, explaining on the back end what you imagined actually transpired, that allowed a hub to be isolated and shut out, and basically stuck, unable to process.
So I mean, Bill brings up a great point about what's behind the curtain, right? And that's something that I don't know. But I think where you were at in Hong Kong, they made vast improvements, right? And they built the infrastructure to be able to handle those type of bets, those breeder cup type bet days. That's a normal day for them, and they shifted. From what I understand, I remember there was a woman, I don't know her name, but she was at the symposium, and she talked a few years back, and she talked about the perception, right? Like just getting the perception in place. So the perception today is that that these things there's things that they may be that are not up to snuff, right? They're not being done correctly, and I think there's a lot of effort that's been done to try to improve them, but then something happens, what happened in the situation that took place, recently, and I think what tends to happen is with all the issues that we have in horse racing, the money was not spent on the infrastructure, meaning the technology equipment. And if it isn't broken, don't fix it, kind of like situation. And I think that's where now you have to really look and to see what it's going to take from a network perspective and a software perspective to bring it up to speed.
To modernize it.
And I think what we talked about earlier about the computer-based wagering situation, that's not going to go away, and you need to have it in place. And what they, their expectation, and they've been here for 20 plus years. They've been around for a long time, and they want the last bet. They want to have their bets come in at the end,
right at the bell,
right at the bell, so that they can make the adjustments based on what the public is betting. And so that's, like you mentioned, what Del Mar's done to try to, and I think some of the racetracks and what they've done, and I know they've done that here too, where they say, okay, you're not gonna participate in these certain pools, so they try to keep a balance for the bettors. And someone like myself, that's Bill. What I do is I gamble, and I've gambled pretty much my whole life, my disposable income. My entire life in this game, and I'll continue to do that. And one of the things is like you're always looking for an edge, and there's ways to find those edges in within the game. But I think with the issues that you have in hand today, like in California, I mean, you bring up great points. I mean, look where we've come from. I mean, California racing was on a thread in 2019. And look at how far they've come. We've come. I say we because I'm, you know, I've been a horse owner and I support what goes on here. And look at how far we've come. And, you know, Bill represents the TOC and he took a stand, and I think it was the right one when it came to giving the dates for Pleasanton. I mean, one of the things that tends to happen a lot of times is the bettors don't have a say, or they don't have like I think I mentioned to you is like I used to love to bet the fairs, and I used to bet them with both hands, and I could tell you stories about, you know, even when they had the Arabians and they had the you know, and one of the things that I stopped betting them. And so what's going to be important was when they move to Pleasanton, is there you know, are people going to bet those races? Like, I love betting Golden Gate. I love the Golden Hour. And then what tends to happen is you start looking at the Golden Gate card, and then the next thing you know, you're betting
sure. The
late pick five.
That's
and you're
the
betting,
whole impetus.
Yeah, that's what happens. Now, if I'm not betting Pleasanton today, what's going to make me bet, and what's going to attract people to bet those races? And then if they don't get people betting those races, right, and they don't get you know,
the handle that they need,
yeah. And then they don't have the money to pay.
It's not a sustainable model,
right? And then what's the plan going to be? And I think that's where the TOC took a stand, right? Where and then the money needed to be, the money needed to be, not to get away from the whole infrastructure question, but I think this all kind of ties in to where you need to have a foot in tomorrow. And I think horsemen in general, I think that's one of the challenges that we have in California, is they don't want to adapt to any kind of change or innovation. They want things to be the same way that they've always been. Hmm. And we struggle with adapting to change, and there's a lot of pushback. I mean, you probably have to deal with that I couldn't imagine your cell phone on a daily basis, how many messages you get. So those are the challenges you see, but you know, the integrity of the betting and integrity of the sport, like you asked me earlier, you know, do people stop betting? And they do, you know, and then I think that's impactful to the game itself.
Well, and you were dealing, and Bill, this is something, I think I brought this up with you last month, and I don't want to use the term again, death spiral, but, you got horsemen here, and I discussed it this week with Phil D'Amato, with Michael McCarthy. I didn't get a chance to discuss it with Mark Glatt, but you got guys that have established toeholds in Kentucky out of necessity, and you know, every horse that's in a barn there is one less that you've got here. So the field sizes, you know, they drop from 8 to 7 to 6.5. This is a problem. I mean, Del Mar gets a boost, it seems, you know, certainly based on last summer, you know, where there was that tremendous start to the meet that sustained them, you know, through September into September. From your perspective on these topics at large, you know, the computer money and putting a cap on it, or controlling it, you know, better. What are your thoughts as in reaction to some of the points Leo brings up?
Well, first, when it comes to, if you look at the stats at the Del Mar Summer Meet the last 2 years, the average field size was actually 9.1 and 8.8. It really was. And I think to the trainers you mentioned, their hearts are in California, and they just need some assurance, and that's what we're working on. And I think we're going to get there. Now, in terms of the tow questions with CAW and things like that, you know, I think the industry, to be fair, has come a long way. I mean, from where we were in 2002, and I'll come back to that, but today, you know, for CAW, the TRPB requires each CAW team, there's a customer code, there's a background check. And I think a lot of the things that need to be in place are there. So I don't want to create panic for anybody listening. I think the industry has made great strides. If you go back to 2002, and I was at NIRA at the time, and I thought I was pretty clued in, and I, you know, and a lot of my information, by the way, back then came from some of our, you know, our day-to-day good customers that would have constant dialogue with me day in and day out, and that's where I'd get a lot of my information about what troubled them and try to find solutions. Now, when it came to the pick six, and I was in my office on that Sunday morning after the Breeders' Cup and realized something was wrong, and I won't go through all the parts of it that of what we did and what took place at the moment, but what came out of that was that a committee was put together and Giuliani and partners were brought in, and we had a lot of the industry people come together, and it was at that moment that I realized the crux of the problem was that Chris Harn, who was the architect of that scam, had recognized that there was no way to really identify race by race, sequence by sequence through that pick six, how many tickets were still live after each leg of the bet. So what he did was he went single, 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 all. But after the first leg, no one would know that if he went back and change, or the first four legs for that matter, that he could go back and change his tickets to reflect the winner as opposed to his initial selection, because there was no scan that would give you concrete information as to what the live tickets looked like after each leg of the bet. Now, honestly, I didn't know that. And I had been, you know, I was in a place where, and I'm not being critical of myself and saying I should have known it, but the industry should have known it. And between those that run the tote companies, it should have been a big concern to them. It slipped through the cracks. And I think it was a big wake-up call at that moment to really try to button down. But it only, to me, signaled to the industry, wow, if someone could pull something like that off, and there was so much money on the line, and again, when I come back to the integrity of the wager and the integrity of the competition and how they're linked, that was a huge wake-up call. Now, I do think that it should be something that's ongoing, that we need to police this, not only when something happens, but we should be doing this on an ongoing basis, and maybe the industry collectively could still do a better job and make it more of a focal point, because it's, you know, think about it, who we are and what we sell to the customer. We sell horse racing and we sell wagering. It's pretty simple. So to make sure that for, you know, customer protection and customer satisfaction, that we have everything in place that we need, I think we should double down and do that.
On that topic, too, I'm curious, in your time at NIRA and subsequently, you know, from an observational standpoint, there's not an industry-wide collective essentially paying assessments toward modernization and keeping the security levels as current as possible. I mean, as far as I know, the industry, in fact, Leo, you and I had this discussion, the industry doesn't have a chief technology officer as a go-to entity. I mean, and where's the jockey club in this, by the way? They've got the jockey club information systems, but I the jockey club is strangely silent whenever this kind of thing happens. I mean, how are we going to pay for this? And nobody seems to want to discuss this. I mean, we got these three tote companies. In fact, just yesterday, I saw where Churchill is selling 49% officially of United Tote to NYRA. So NYRA and CDI own United. Global is the Australian operator, and Stronach Group owns Amtote. Somebody's got to be paying for this, and not the players, by the way, who invariably pay for everything. I mean, is this ever discussed, as far as you know, Bill?
Well, I don't know, Steve. I mean, I do think the industry's come a long way. I think with the TRPB and with the Jockey Club, I do think in terms of an independent audit, industry audit of the tote, you can't rely on the three tote companies. There still has to be independent assessment to make sure. And when I say that, I'm not talking about just making sure that everything works properly, but also to identify improvements that could be made to either tighten the system or make it more efficient going forward. It's something that I think we should be doing on a regular basis. And these independent assessments or audits, I do think there's room for improvement. And it shouldn't be tote-driven. It should be driven by the industry in coordination with the totes to try to find that. And I come back to even when we uncovered the Breeders' Cup Pick 6 fix, and we spoke to what was then Autotote at the time to make them aware on the morning after that there was a problem, the initial response was, it's impossible with ITSP. It can't happen. And, of course, I couldn't hang up the phone quick enough because I knew it did happen. And so that's why it can't be tote-driven. It has to be an independent assessment, an independent audit, just probably like any other industry would do. And I think we do that to some degree now, but I do personally think that more could be done.
Who should be obliged to finance it, in your way of thinking?
Well, it's a good question. I'll defer on that. But I think the key thing is it needs to be done. Who's going to pay for it is always a great question. But I think in this particular case, it shouldn't be an obstacle. I mean, we should be. I mean, I don't think it's a question of who. I think it's incumbent upon us to do it. I don't think it's a question of who's going to pay the bill. It's the fact that we've got to define the brief and what we need in terms of the audit or the assessment and just get on with it.
Now, and we should note, other jurisdictions, and when I say jurisdictions, I mean international jurisdictions, have had the benefit of the ability to create their systems as a monolith, TAB, for instance, in Australia, New Zealand. It's they're, you know, as it happens, Australia probably has God knows how many racing associations. I mean, there's a racetrack in every outback community from Perth to Melbourne, but there's one tote system. They didn't have to deal with what we've dealt with, which was Amtote, Scientific Games, United, etc. You know, all these amalgamations that each actually developed their own technology, which was a further issue about marrying the technologies and making them speak to each other, you know, cohesively, right? That's a nightmare. I mean, for years ago, that was always the issue when it came. You know, one of the reasons why, if one racetrack, when Bill Nader came up with the Grand Slam, it wasn't instantly adopted because the other tote companies had to write the code. They couldn't just simply adopt the code that was developed at the time with who? With Amtote or with?
At the time, it was that Autotote, and it was and it's still not, by the way.
Yeah, you can't bet. I can't bet it here.
Still can't bet.
Yeah.
And that was gosh, I don't know how many years ago. That was many, many years ago when I was still at NIRA, probably around 2000. It's probably 20 years ago. So it's still not available on certain totes. And the look, with the interface and through the ITSP, the totes have to speak to each other. That's how wagers are commingled. And even in the international arena, when I started, when I was in Hong Kong, I was tasked with going to the government in Hong Kong and getting approval for Hong Kong Jockey Club to export its content overseas. And the bet and we got that. And when we dealt, let's say, with America or France or Australia or New Zealand or Singapore or whoever, you had to then get the unique rules of wagering in Hong Kong approved and get the interface correct with the guest sites overseas. And give you an idea, just to show you how it differs, a daily double in Hong Kong, if you have the winner of the first race and your selection in the second leg of the daily double finishes second, you get a consolation. In a pick three, same applies. If you have the winners of the first two legs and your selection in the third leg runs second, you get a consolation. So it's not apples to apples. And those interfaces had to be, there was a lot of testing between the host and the guest to get that across. You know, there's the jackpot bets in Hong Kong, the six up, which is our version of the pick six. If Steve Bick has five winners in the first five legs, or in the one leg he misses, his horse runs third. That's a losing ticket, Steve. Sorry, five correct and a third. But Leo has none correct and has in each leg a horse that runs second in all six legs. He's entitled to the consolation. So even communicating these different
nuances.
Yeah, and getting the totes to adjust, it's doable. It can be done. So the interface globally can work through the technology that's in place. But I think we can all learn from each other. And when we talk about independent assessment and audit, I don't think you'd look at it from a narrow lens. I think you look at it from a global lens to see maybe something somebody else is doing better that can be incorporated. And so I take that more holistic approach. And I do think it's something that should be done on a regular basis, whether it's annually or twice a year, or maybe to some end it's being done and I don't know about it, but I do think we need to double down. And I think the customer deserves that, and that when something happens in our response, we're ready to defend, again, the integrity of the wager as much as we're defending the integrity of the competition.
Bill Nader with us. We've got about 15 minutes to close out the 2 weeks here and 5 weeks on the road. Leo Vukmanovic sitting in all morning as well, and hitting a few, you know, industry at large topics. Bill, what the challenges in California, you know, notwithstanding, what are the most transferable positives that can, when you talk, you know, thinking globally, universal application, what, from an international perspective to the domestic product, what can we do better here that, you know, can be executed, can be applied from your experience? And, you know, and in knowing that you were coming back to North America, you know, and with potential at any time, you know, down the road to, you know, rejoin a racetrack management organization, you know, different from the capacity you're doing now. I mean, what things would you like to see adopted in North America that we can either do better or do fresh?
Well, there's nothing I'm going to say that's going to be a bombshell, but I think in my time in Hong Kong and having my eyes open, because when I worked at NIRA, to be honest, I thought I would never leave NIRA until the Hong Kong door opened up. And by going over there, it was really my first opportunity to really experience horse racing overseas. I really had no real knowledge of it going in, but the fundamentals, Steve, in terms of the way the Hong Kong Jockey Club operates, And in Hong Kong, you know, you're the operator and you're also the regulator. So you're in complete control, but they don't outsource anything. I mean, it's, you know, from food and beverage to the tote system to broadcasting, you know, everything is vertically integrated straight up and down. So all the quality control within that organization is right under their roof. And so if there's any issues, and as I said earlier, and they're also the regulator. So you never really have to look outside your own headquarters to get the right people in the room to solve a problem if a problem presents itself. So the reaction time and the call to action to respond when something pops up is much quicker. But the key thing I think that I came away with, and it's a minor thing, or it sounds minor but it's not, is in terms of segmentation, whether it be for the horse owner or for the customer, the attention to detail on customer segmentation to know exactly what the different customer segments are. You know, there would be, for example, you know, the public that are just coming to sit in the grandstand and have a bet, maybe have something to eat or drink, and then there would be high-volume players, and everybody who's anybody is betting into those pools because those pools are so deep. So the wide range of customers throughout the segment, and even to identify, okay, who's coming or who's betting on our races on a Wednesday night at Happy Valley that's not participating at Sha Tin and why? And who is participating on a Sunday at Sha Tin and is not participating in the parimutuel process on a Wednesday at Happy Valley and why? What are the triggers? Or what are the things each customer segment is looking for? How can we improve the experience? How do we take the experience from end to end, from the moment they arrive at the track to the moment they depart, and make that experience better? Knowing that just like in America, that, you know, at the most 10% of the betting volume is occurring on track, they would transfer that same methodology to customers who are betting through account wagering, which, by the way, every single customer who's betting through a betting account is a customer of the Hong Kong Jockey Club. So they own all of that space. They own all of the off-course betting branches, which are about 100. So that vertical integration there is just incredible. They own, literally own and operate the whole show at every level. And they control everything from every level, and they do an exceptional job at it. And they're very transparent in terms of the information they provide. And in the case of if there was something that popped up and it needed an explanation, they would never shy away. They'll always be there with a solid, sound, and logical explanation. So their accountability and their responsibility to what they have in terms of their license is completely respected and fundamentally sound at every single level. And I think as an industry, if there's anything we can learn, it's how do we emulate that? Forget about the big ticket items that are hard to replicate, such as that every horse owner has to be a member of the jockey club. That's not going to happen here. How every groom or every hot walker or exercise rider has to be, not an exercise rider, but anybody who works on the backstretch. There are a few exercise riders that might be expats, but they're all Hong Kong residents. Even if you're an expat trainer in Hong Kong, your assistant trainer has to be a Hong Kong resident. So there's certain things that they do that wouldn't apply here. But what they do in terms of a very well thought out, segmented approach about how to make the experience better for every important stakeholder on an end-to-end basis, and how they could improve that experience to improve their performance and their bottom line, which is obviously the motivator, is exceptional. And I got there, I got to tell you, I rode the wave perfectly. After some tough years at Naira, we went through some very tough times with a deferred prosecution and fighting for the franchise. I walked into the Hong Kong Jockey Club at the time when wagering had declined from the point of the handover to mainland China in 1997. The handle at that point was 93 billion Hong Kong. It had dropped down to 60 billion at the time I arrived. So a pretty big drop from 93 to 60.
And about the same as we've suffered in 20 years.
Yeah. And these are Hong Kong dollars. But at that time...
But percentage-wise.
Yeah. And I came in, and timing was perfect because that's when it took off. And just to let everybody know where it went, and this is with Macau in casino. Macau casino presence, which is, you know, four times Vegas, is only an hour away by ferry and 15 minutes by helicopter. So in the face of that challenge, the handle went from 60 billion in 2007 to the point I left, it was 140 billion. So,
Jesus.
So they did the Hong Kong Jockey Club did a tremendous job in turning that around, growing the sport, and it's done systematically. It's not done through some kind of a magic show. It's a concerted effort to really to make sure that you're doing everything possible. Now, they do have the advantages. In terms of a sporting landscape there, they don't have competition. There's no football or baseball or hockey or basketball that would even compare. You can watch it on TV, but it's not played there. The only sport that's played live that really matters in Hong Kong is horse racing. You'll get the Rugby Sevens, which, by the way, were last weekend. It's a three-day event. It's massive. You might get an occasional golf tournament or a tennis tournament. But the one thing that has vertical reach throughout the full calendar is horse racing, 88 days a year. And the media coverage is phenomenal. Culturally, it's, widely accepted. It's a big part of who Hong Kong is, who the people are. And the Hong Kong Jockey Club has three betting products: horse racing, sports betting, which is limited to soccer. And the third betting product is the lottery. And I'm telling you, the lottery is insignificant. They will not bet on the lottery in Hong Kong because it's a game of luck. It's not a game of skill.
Right.
So the lottery will be outperformed by horse racing by a margin of about 23-1.
So, it is a limited universe. It's not oversaturated. The 2 days a week, Happy Valley Wednesday, tomorrow morning, I'm sure Dick Powell's listening and Dick will have some thoughts. And then, of course, the Saturday, Sunday, shot team cards. The thing, Bill, that jumps in my mind that you can appreciate when you talk about, tracking the business and being, focused on the core customer. You were on hand during a period where an odious presence shackling Naira marketing, and that was you, the New York State Racing and Wagering Board, which stopped letting Naira send out mystery vouchers, which stopped letting owners and trainers have companion passes to give to their spouse, that wouldn't allow Naira to give a racing form to their best customer. The most insane, just tamping down of potential. You couldn't, you could track the business, I suppose, but and then not to mention the completely awful structure of OTB and that should have been feeding into the Naira product that ended up actually doing the opposite, basically taking away. There was the complete antithesis of all of those elements.
Yeah, I have to say, though, Steve, my time at Naira, we had a great relationship with the State Racing and Wagering Board, so fortunately for me...
Well, the Franchise Oversight Board interflumped on a lot of that.
Yeah. But look, those are the kind of things where the industry has to come together and understand, that was the beauty in Hong Kong, right? You were the operator and you were the regulator.
If you had an idea, you could do it.
But you couldn't... You had to respect the responsibility of that and make sure, because the one thing the Hong Kong Jockey Club would know is that for a business that big, the one thing you can't have is an integrity breach. And the incentive to cheat is probably greater there because of the size of the pools, right? So there's so you had to take that very seriously. I want to come back to one thing in Hong Kong that when I mentioned some of the things that were done there. The other thing would be on the racing side. Now, I was executive director of racing, and when I went in there, I think for the first 3 months, I just wanted to observe because it was something different than what we have here. Now, in Hong Kong, for people listening, this is a much different format than we understand here. Or there's no claiming races. The horses are Hong Kong-based horses, so there's about 1,250 horses. And Dick Powell can elaborate more on this tomorrow, but Dick would know it well. These are captive Hong Kong horses, and it's a handicap system. So I would say 98% of the races in Hong Kong are handicaps, whereby, again, there's no claiming, but the races that you're going to run in are a function of what your horse's handicap rating is. So there are five classes of races, classes 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then you have your group races. Basically, that's the way it's structured. There are only about 10 races a year where horses can come in from another jurisdiction and compete, the major group one races. Otherwise, you've got to be a Hong Kong resident horse to compete. If a horse is rated 60, then it can run in a class 3, which is horses rated 80 to 60. So you have a firm number, and if you're in the class 3 race and you're at the bottom of the rating band, you're rated 60, you'll carry 115 pounds, whereas the horse that's rated 80 will carry 135 pounds. So it's 1 pound for each point. Also, a horse that's rated 60 could have the option of running in class 4, which is 60 down to 40, but in that case, instead of carrying 115 at the bottom of class 3, he's at the top of class 4, that horse would be assigned 135. And then every horse that's for every point below him would get that weight allowance. So that is that's how they try to make the races competitive. That's how the structure is designed. And that's how field sizes average over 12 per race.
Well, and as it happens, and Rick Hammerly has discussed this, I mentioned Sal Sinatra's name, there's a movement afoot on that front domestically. And there may be a landmark shift in North America here in coming years.
And it would need modification here because it would be so different than what we're accustomed to. But it's something that I wanted to mention because if there is one thing that is possible, a modified version of that is something that would be on the table.
Well, and there may be potential for us to shift to the post-race auctions, the auction race that's done elsewhere in the world as opposed to the claiming, which would, frankly, take out a lot of the motivation of droppers. I mean, that era seems to be winding down. Also winding down is this unbelievable 5-week trip that I think I'll be hard-pressed to duplicate again, although I'll be in Louisville 2 weeks, Nashville for Iroquois, and a week in Baltimore, so that's 4 weeks. But just tremendous. Leo, thank you. Appreciate you coming out.
Always a pleasure to be here with you, Steve.
Outstanding. Leo Vukmanovich, Big Leo. Bill Nader joining us live as well from the TOC and with just a career of experience and understanding and level-headedness, which is invaluable.
And, Steve, thanks for spending the time in California, and thanks for everything you do on behalf of the industry. We appreciate what you do, and it means a lot, and I think I speak for a lot of people when I say that.
I thank you. It's my pleasure. I love the game like all of us. Thanks to Santa Anita, thanks to Nate Newby and the team here, and Aiden Butler and everybody that made this really a unique experience of 2 weeks. I'm going to miss all these guys here, but we'll be back. With Del Mar for Breeders' Cup, but usually I make a December stop, too, in advance of the season. Back home tomorrow in Greenwich, the Greenwich studio. I saw my wife just a couple of days ago, so it's not like I, you know, it's still nice to go home. Thanks to Bill. Thanks to Leo. Thanks to Alan Foreman and the fabulous news out of Maryland. And Joe Skirto, who joined us from Minnesota, where the news is not so good. But hopefully Randy Sampson can talk some sense into legislators and the tribal interests. Thanks, everybody. Replay 6 to 9 here on Sirius XM. Talk to you from home in the morning.
Horsemen, nominate now for Penn National's biggest day of the season, the $400,000 Grade 3 Penn Mile. In the $150,000 Penn Oaks will both be run Friday, May 31st, on a card that also includes two Pennsylvania bred